We've got a much bigger set of resources to draw upon as we move together through these challenging times.
Alaska telecom company GCI is being sold. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Tuesday, April 4th. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, Pac Rim Coal halts work on the Chewitnut Coal project, at least for now.
At this point in time, it's just a victory for us, but we'll keep an ear to the ground and see what's going to happen.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by Alaska Pipeline Service Company, sustaining Alaska's pipeline for 40 years and counting.
Alaska's largest telecommunications provider, GCI, is being acquired by an even larger company. Colorado-based Liberty Ventures Group is reportedly paying $1.12 billion for GCI. GCI says nothing will change for Alaskans who use its cable, phone, and internet services when the deal is finalized sometime early next year. Alaska Public Media's Casey Grove has more.
You know when one really big fish swallows another big fish? That's kind of what's going on with Liberty Ventures and GCI. Except these aren't fish, they're giant telecommunications companies worth billions of dollars. GCI's chief financial officer, Pete Pounds, says the deal announced Tuesday represents the joining of some $5 billion in assets.
That's a real nice ballast to have there to weather, you know, what we think are some challenging economic times. We've got a much bigger set of resources to draw upon as we move together through these challenging times.
Pound says the challenging times include a bleak financial outlook for Alaska and continued job losses. For its part, GCI says its thousands of employees aren't going anywhere and its customers won't see a difference.
The situation in Alaska changes not one bit. This is a financial company that is buying an operating company. And so, you know, they're not looking to be involved in our business on a day-to-day basis.
Pound says what Liberty Ventures is interested in is buying an Alaska-grown company that started small in an Anchorage apartment and grew to span the entire state. If the deal checks out with regulatory agencies, GCI expects the acquisition to close in about 9 months. The company's new name will be GCI Liberty, and will be held under the subsidiary Liberty Interactive, which owns stakes in other telecommunications companies, as well as familiar names such as FTD, the flower delivery service, and Evite, the online invitation service. GCI is adamant that there will not be any changes to the service customers have come to rely upon. For Alaska Public Media, I'm Casey Grove.
Residents of the tiny Cook Inlet village of Tyonek are celebrating the news that a company attempting to develop a massive coal mine near their village has shelved the project. Pac Rim Coal has been pursuing the Chewitna Coal Project for more than a decade, but it has been fighting with environmental groups and members of the Tyonek Native Village. Last week, the company told state and federal regulatory agencies it would no longer pursue permitting on the project. From Alaska's Energy Desk in Juneau, Rasha McChesney has more.
Janelle Baker got a text at 7:50 a.m. Monday morning with news that has spread like wildfire through her home village of Tyonek.
Well, I yelled in joy, saying yes, that they finally stopped.
They are Pac Rim Coal Mining Company. Baker and many other residents of the village have been fighting a proposed coal mine to be built on the nearby Chewitna River. It's about 45 miles southwest of Anchorage and less than 10 miles from her village. Last week, the company told state and federal regulators that it's shelving the project and won't move forward with the permitting process. State officials say the company told them it was looking for a funding partner and couldn't find one. And the news percolated through the village over the weekend. Arthur Standifer is president of Tyonek's Native Council. He says he called at least 20 people to share the news, and they are overjoyed.
What it means for us is our fish will continue to be here for future generations. Also, our wildlife, like the bears and the moose and the other animals, will be secure, and they'll be here. They'll have a safe place to be.
The Chewitna coal mine has been in development for decades. The project got its final environmental approval from the Environmental Protection Agency in 1990, but coal prices crashed and it didn't move forward. It was rekindled in 2006, but it's faced both a long and complex regulatory permitting process through state and federal agencies, and stiff opposition from tribal members and environmental groups. But while the company has shelved the project, a move many in Tyonek say is a win, that doesn't mean it's dead. Russell Kirkham manages the state's coal regulatory program.
If Pacrim or another company got access to the leases, it's possible for them to restart the project. If that was to happen fairly quickly, they could possibly start fairly close to where they are now in terms of the process.
And it's not uncommon for there to be a long lead time in developing projects like this. Kyle Moselle is a large mine project manager for the Department of Natural Resources. He says that it's always surprising when a company backs away from a permitting process because it costs a lot of money to make it through.
Mining of any sort, whether it's surface mining like a coal project like Chewitna or load mining, there's no guarantees in it. It's a rigorous review process.
Back in Tyonek, Arthur Standifer says villagers are cautiously optimistic about Pacrim's decision.
At this point in time, it's just a victory for us, but we'll keep an ear to the ground and see what's going to happen.
Moselle says he hopes people understand the context and the timeline for a project like Pacrim's, and that the state is ready to review any proposal like it that would develop the state's resources. From Alaska's Energy Desk in Juneau, I'm Rasha McChesney.
An oil company operating in Alaska will pay $10 million for violating federal law that prohibits foreign vessels from transporting merchandise within the United States. The U.S. Department of Justice announced a settlement today with Fury Operating Alaska. The company primarily operates in Cook Inlet. In 2011, it brought a drill rig to work in the kitchen lights unit in Cook Inlet. But when Fury transported the rig from the Gulf of Mexico to Alaska, it used a foreign-flagged vessel without getting away. Waiver from the Department of Homeland Security. Waivers may be granted if no U.S. vessel is able to transport the merchandise. Fury has been contesting the penalty since 2012. No one from the company immediately returned a phone call about the settlement. The rig is still in Alaska. It's currently docked in Seward. Fury isn't using it anymore. The company replaced it with a larger rig. President Donald Trump today signed a bill repealing federal limits on predator hunting on Alaska's National Wildlife Refuges. The bill's House sponsor was Congressman Don Young. He says the Statehood Act and other measures make it clear Alaska has the right to manage hunting across the state.
This was a matter of law, and that's the reason I'm so adamant about it. It was an encroachment upon the state of Alaska.
Opponents, especially the Humane Society of the United States, wanted to prevent certain methods of killing bears and wolves on refuges, such as killing the animals in their dens. The Alaska Board of Game doesn't usually allow that, but state law gives it the authority to okay it. Young says the next battle will be getting the feds to respect the repeal.
I've already heard from Fish and Wildlife, I said, we're not going to change. Well, we'll see about that. There's a new sheriff in town, so we'll see.
The National Park Service still has a predator hunting rule like the one repealed today that would apply to Alaska's national preserves. A court challenge is pending. A Washington, D.C. environmental group is accusing the Tongass National Forest of breaking its own timber sale rules. Public Employees for Environmental Responsibility cites internal Forest Service documents in its critique of Tongass management. The National Forest includes most of Southeast Alaska. Executive Director Jeff Rook says forest managers didn't sufficiently review or monitor sales. He says they also allowed logging companies to cut corners.
And as a result, there were significant monetary losses, and they didn't accomplish their environmental goals. And the oversight was so poor that the Tongass National Forest didn't even have copies of the contract, let alone the backup data.
Alaska Forest Service officials responded with a press release, but wouldn't grant an interview or answer specific questions. In the release, officials said they're already addressing issues raised in the internal review cited by its critics. That includes updating the appraisal process and making improvements to its timber sale administration. Among its complaints, the Public Employees Group says Tongass managers improperly allowed loggers to cherry-pick more valuable timber within sale areas, including spruce and cedar.
What they seem to be saying is the Forest Service should have forced them to log more hemlock trees, you know, or lower-value trees, and that would have got them more stumpage. And that, doesn't make any sense. If you harvest at lower value trees, you get less stumpage because their trees are worth less.
The Ketchikan-based Trade Association has lobbied the Forest Service to provide enough timber to keep what's left of the region's industry alive. Public Employees for Environmental Responsibility is calling for an in-depth forensic audit. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, the Alaska Railroad suffers a revenue decline.
As the economy changes around here, we're a bit of a canary in the coal mine, and show how that can affect things downstream.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station. Older Persons Action Group publishes Senior Voice, Alaska's only statewide publication for seniors, and is an excellent source of information for families and caregivers. SeniorVoiceAlaska.com. This message sponsored by OPAG.
10 gallons or less. That's how much crude oil state regulators think leaked from a pipeline in Cook Inlet last weekend. The pipeline's owner, Hillcorp, has an even smaller estimate, 3 gallons. The oil company says that's based on the number and size of the oil sheen spotted and the amount of oil recovered from the pipeline after the platform was shut down. Kristen Ryan, who heads up spill prevention and response for the state, says she's fairly confident the final estimate won't exceed 10 gallons, but Ryan adds pinning down exactly how much oil escaped won't be easy.
This is always a really hot point and any response, and unfortunately it's just not an exact science. It is hard to really quantify a release. One of the main factors we use is how much of the product was recovered, and in this situation we've not recovered any product.
Ryan says the state will continue reviewing the available evidence. For example, they're looking at Hillcorp's records on how much oil was in the line and how much oil the company was able to pump out of the line into a storage tank. Divers will also inspect the pipeline when dangerous ice conditions in the inlet dissipate. That will factor into how the state penalizes Hillcorp for the leak. Ryan says the state has zero tolerance for oil spills, so a fine is likely. But she also praised Hillcorp for how they handled the leak.
This probably wasn't a lot of oil, so that's to us a success story. The response went correctly. The company did what it needed to do and didn't put anybody in harm's way and was able to get rid of the oil before a larger release occurred.
But Lois Epstein of the Wilderness Society says she's skeptical of Hillcorp's estimate that just 3 gallons of oil leaked into the inlet. She says the pipeline is 75 feet below the inlet surface, so some of the oil may not have risen to the surface.
We need to know not just the initial estimate, which I think sounds suspiciously low, but we need to know what are the assumptions behind it and come to some sort of technical consensus of what the actual amount is.
Epstein is calling for Hillcorp to publicly release the data they're using to calculate how much oil leaked. The state's final estimate is expected in a couple of weeks. The Alaska Railroad Corporation had a rough year in 2016, where it saw a dramatic drop in revenue. The company finished 2016 $4.4 million in the red. Alaska Public Media's Josh Edge reports.
Overall, the railroad's revenues for everything from passenger travel to freight transportation totaled just under $170 million in 2016, more than a $15 million drop from the previous year. Tim Sullivan is the manager of external affairs for the Alaska Railroad. He says the corporation's drop in revenue is indicative of the state's overall economy, and much of the railroad's losses can be attributed to a big drop in freight revenue.
What we do see is that as construction projects go down around the state, we're moving less product in terms of like gravel for road products or for building projects. So as the economy changes around here, we're a bit of a canary in the coal mine, and show how that can affect things downstream.
He says the railroad only moved about 70,000 tons of coal last year, down from 1.2 million tons in 2011. The drop forced the closure of the corporation's coal loading facility last summer. Sullivan also says the shuttering and subsequent dismantling of the Flint Hills refinery in North Pole has had a significant impact on the railroad's bottom line over the last few years. Overall, the railroad's freight revenue dropped by 16% last year and is down more than 44% since 2008. Moving forward, Sullivan says the railroad is hoping to do more business with the military as it increases its presence in Fairbanks. He says increased oil production could also help the railroad directly.
Some increased production and research and drilling up on the North Slope. We'll be moving more product through our barge service and keep looking for other lines of business as we go through that.
Sullivan says another challenge last year was an impasse between the Alaska Railroad and the municipality of Anchorage over a pool of federal funds that is typically split between the two parties. That led to a loss of more than $7 million in budgeted funds. He says discussions between the municipality and the railroad about the funds are ongoing. But Sullivan says there is one bright spot from 2016, an increase in ridership of passenger trains.
Including the Coastal Classic that goes down to Seward from Anchorage, and a lot more travelers that are heading up to Denali on the Denali Star that heads up north. So a lot of increase in traffic, not just in the summertime also, but in the winter.
Sullivan says more Alaskans are taking the train than in past years, but he attributes much of the growth to tourism.
Because people look at Alaska as exotic but safe. And with the things that are going on around the world, they have the opportunities to come up here as independent travelers or get on cruise ships with package travel. And getting on the railroad seems to be a big part of those trips for a lot of the people who make their way up here.
Sullivan says the railroad anticipates this year's revenues to remain fairly flat. In Anchorage, I'm Josh Edge.
The man hired to serve as Unalaska's new fire chief has been fired after he was charged yesterday with sexual assault in Illinois. David D.J. Dunn was scheduled to arrive in Anchorage before starting work on the island next week. Instead, he was arraigned on felony charges for drugging and sexually assaulting a man who attended his going-away party. As a result of the charges, the city of Unalaska has terminated Dunn's employment. City manager Dave Martinson says the news came as a surprise. Dunn had passed the city's vetting process before he was hired last month.
Nothing had turned up in any kind of a background stuff that we do. We were all shocked. I found out by an email from a reporter out of Illinois.
Dunn worked as a fire captain and paramedic in Savoy, Illinois, but he also has experience in Unalaska. When he was hired as fire chief, city officials called Dunn highly qualified for the position, citing his part-time work with Guardian Flight, a company that provides emergency medical transportation for the island. Now, Martinson says, Unalaska will resume its search for a new fire chief, which has lasted about a year.
While it's frustrating for us, our concern isn't for the process we're going through. Our concern is for the victim in this case. Hopefully, the victim will be able to overcome this as he proceeds through life.
Dunn is due in Illinois court again on April 18th. He could serve up to 15 years in prison. C. Grant knew the Trump administration wanted to eliminate its budget for next fiscal year, but those cuts could come much sooner. The organization says the White House is asking Congress to slash this year's funding, too. That could mean the end for dozens of Alaska programs focusing on fisheries and climate change. From Alaska's Energy Desk, Elizabeth Jenkins has more.
Paula Kullenberg, the director of Alaska Sea Grant, says this latest news was unexpected. Sea Grant supports research at 33 universities nationwide, including the University of Alaska Fairbanks. But as early as this spring, some of those projects could be on the line.
It's anxiety-making to have this hanging over your head.
Kullenberg says Sea Grant found out about the additional cuts from an agency that acts as its congressional liaison. She says the White House is proposing cutting $30 million from Sea Grant's programs for this year. That's not to be confused with the Trump administration's ask to eliminate the Sea Grant funding for next year.
I think that's highly unusual. I've never seen anything like that.
Alaska Sea Grant receives matching funds from the university and the state. But Kullenberg says those federal dollars make up the program's core funding. It pays for projects that measure the economic vitality of the seafood industry and helps communities adapt to climate change.
We're supporting 10 graduate students with research fellowships, 3 Alaska Sea Grant state fellows, coastal issues.
And the list goes on.
There's not very much in our program that wouldn't be severely disabled if that came to pass.
Congress is debating at the end of this month what Sea Grant's budget will be for the rest of 2017. Senators Lisa Murkowski and Dan Sullivan have shown support for Sea Grant. They've asked for, quote, adequate funding for next fiscal year. Kullenberg says she's remaining hopeful for this year, too. From Alaska's Energy Desk, I'm Elizabeth Jenkins in Juneau.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by
Arctic Wire Rope and Supply, now distributing Boss Industrial Log Splitters, stocking gas and electric up to 34 ton, on the web at arcticwirerope.com.
Racers and fans gather this week at Summit Lake for the annual Arctic Man Ski and Snowgo Classic. Race day is scheduled for Thursday in the Hoodoo Mountains off the Richardson Highway, where organizer Howard Thies says wind has taken a toll on the snowpack.
And so it's got a hard base. We got a snowcat, so we'll get a course in.
Thies says past champions in the snowboard and ski divisions are on the roster, but the overall number of teams registered is far below last year's 65.
Looks like about 26 teams for the whole thing, which is really low this year, but, you know, I don't know what's going on. We got what we got.
Competition aside, Arctic Man typically draws thousands to watch, ride, and party in the mountains. Thies says early reservations for campsites were also down this year.
You know, the economy's tight. Everybody understands that. But we're fine. We're going to make budget. We're going to make it go.
Thies notes many Arctic Man fans wait until the last minute before deciding to attend. This year's Arctic Man event also includes a kids' snowcross race that's attracted 65 to 70 competitors. Last Thursday, we commemorated the anniversary of the treaty the U.S. signed with Russia to buy Alaska. That afternoon, an Alaskan artist went on a special mission in Washington, D.C. He wanted to bring a heavy package to the spot where William Seward signed the Treaty of Session exactly 150 years prior. Alaska Public Media's Washington correspondent Liz Ruskin explains.
Yes, David, and this is Judy, my sister.
Hello.
We're the artists.
David Rubin lives in Ketchikan. Lately, he and his sister have spent a lot of time in their mother's basement in New York State sculpting a life-size statue of William Seward, a bronze that will stand in Juneau. It's at a foundry now on the East Coast, but the Rubens and a group of supporters brought an 8-pound hunk of the statue out for a walk in downtown Washington. The chunk was wrapped in bubble wrap, carried in a sturdy tote bag. David says it's an important part of the statue.
This is the actual bronze
Replication of the Treaty of Session. That's going to go in Seward, the statue of Seward's hand.
He hoped bringing it to the spot where the real treaty was signed would impart a touch of authenticity to the replica. His friend Lorelei Lafleur offered to schlep it.
Wow. Holy smokes. No, Dave.
First stop, Seward's home on Lafayette Square, steps from the White House. Here, a man working in league with John Wilkes Booth came to assassinate Seward on the same night Lincoln was shot. Rubin says Seward's son confronted the would-be killer on the staircase.
And the gun misfired. It jammed. And that's Alaskan history, but not yet made, but that was key.
The intruder, though, had a knife. Rubin says he made it into the bedroom where Seward lay, recovering from a carriage accident.
And he's attacking him with this Bowie knife. The metal brace from the accident saved his life.
Seward was forever disfigured. Rubin says they decided to sculpt his face with scars, in part because they learned the Tlinkets, who met Seward when he visited Alaska in 1869, were impressed by his injuries. Still, Rubin says it was a tough artistic choice.
He didn't like his picture being taken after that, so we were worried he'd be upset, but if we explained, no, they see you as a great warrior.
By the way, Seward's house, long gone.
It might have been where that brick, this new brick building is, which is a federal building, it looks like.
Wayne Jensen is from Juneau. He's a member of the Alaska Historical Commission and co-chairs the committee that picked Rubin to make the statue. Jensen says a key moment for the Treaty of Session happened at Seward's house the night before the treaty signing.
The 29th, Seward and his family were playing whist, which is a form of bridge, about 10 o'clock at night, and Edward DeStockel came to the house
Destokol was the Russian ambassador. Jensen says the czar had just sent word that he would agree to sell Alaska.
And he said, well, I can meet with in your office tomorrow morning, and we'll finalize the negotiations. And Seward, who knew that the Congress was about to adjourn, said, why wait till tomorrow? Let's just do the treaty tonight.
They met at midnight at the State Department, a mile away. So that's where the artists and their entourage walked with the bronze treaty. David Rubin looks something like an Alaskan prospector, all gray and whiskery, in a felt-brimmed hat. He describes Seward as a short, disheveled man who changed history.
He was a kind-hearted person, I know that, and I know there's a lot of controversy over, you know, him being the face of Manifest Destiny.
In 1869, when Seward was in Sitka, he spoke with disdain about Alaska Natives, and many first Alaskans see the treaty now as a tool of their colonization. Rubin, though, points to Seward's active opposition to slavery. Seward's home in New York was a stop on the Underground Railroad, and he had a long association with Harriet Tubman. As the small party of Alaskans walked north, downtown gave way to a gentrifying neighborhood, liquor stores and vacant storefronts mixed with new, trendy shops.
Is this the corner? This is it? Oh my God.
Eventually, the crew reached a site of a 19th century orphanage that, for a few years, was leased to the State Department. Lafleur set down the bronze burden to double-check on her phone.
Okay, Orphans Asylum / State Department, vacated by both, and then razed. Okay, so that was the gas station that used to be the storage building. This, we're looking at the State Department. It's beautiful!
It is not. It's now a block of 1970s-era housing. Rubin wasn't disappointed. He and his sister walked past the security fence and took a spot on the small lawn. They unwrapped the bronze replica treaty.
Wait, David, read it.
Read it?
Yeah.
Whereas a treaty between the United States of America and His Majesty the Emperor of all of Russia.
Did this happen at this particular spot? Is
yes.
That where you...
The scene attracted a guy from a nearby bus stop. Lafleur filled him in.
What year was that? I didn't even get that. What year?
150 years ago.
Oh, wow, right after.
Yeah, today's the 150th anniversary of the signing.
What came of it?
Alaska was purchased.
Seward's Folly.
Yes.
With the reading complete, Rubin wrapped up the chunk of bronze to leave.
We're now going to take it and place it in Seward's hand and the statue's hand and weld it there forever. But it was here where it was actually signed. This is it.
The statue will be unveiled in Juneau in July. Reporting from Washington, I'm Liz Ruskin.
We did it.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. Tonight's stories can be found at our website, alaskapublic.org. We had reports tonight from Casey Grove, Josh Edge, and Elizabeth Harbaugh in Anchorage, Rasha McChesney, Ed Schoenfeld, and Elizabeth Jenkins in Juneau, Liz Ruskin in Washington, D.C., Laura Craigle in Unalaska, and Dan Bross in Fairbanks. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron, Wesley Early is our web editor, and I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
Alaska Pipeline Service Company, sustaining Alaska's pipeline for 40 years and counting.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.